Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining. Always a pleasure. To learn with you on a Wednesday night. It's great to see everyone.
I was just wondering, how was your class this morning?
It was great. Sorry, Mr.
I couldn't get into it. I tried to get in.
Did you really? I don't know. These links are so annoying sometimes. I don't know what I did wrong. I'm happy to talk about it later. Figure out what's going wrong.
Are you going to put it on?
It's on Waiutora. I sent out an email.
Oh, is it? Under what?
I'll give the details in a bit, but check out the email I sent, yep. Okay?
Okay.
That is, Martin's referring to my series on Provence, medieval Provence. But today, we're going to talk about free will. Free will, free choice, and its relation to the tree of knowledge. So let's do a bit of a review. Let's get back to where we're talking about. So last week, we discussed a very obvious question. And one approach to the question. The question goes as follows. If you remember correctly, it says that there's this tree in the Garden of Eden that is called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now, it's a fair interpretation to claim that this tree of knowledge of good and evil would give those who eat it the knowledge to discern between good and evil. Seems like a fair interpretation. Which would imply that before people ate from this tree, they did not have knowledge to discern between good and evil. Now, this is very problematic on a number of fronts. Anybody remember any of the questions? Why is it problematic to suggest that only after eating from the tree of knowledge did Adam and Eve attain knowledge to discern between good and evil? Why is it a problem?
Oh, one problem I had is, did they have free will to eat or not to eat?
Right. That's exactly the point. If they didn't, meaning they didn't
they
know.
You don't have free will to do that because you need to do that to survive.
You believe in determinism.
Right. So Paul's saying, tell me if I'm wrong, is that if they indeed did not know between good and evil, then it follows that they did not know evil to eat.
Paul, you can break that down.
Between good and evil. And if they did not know it was evil, how could you penalize them for doing so? And furthermore, if you don't know the knowledge between good and evil, then how can you make any decisions, really? Like, aren't decisions basically on this pivot between good and evil? And if you don't know the difference, then what choice do you have? And there's another stronger question that the Rambam asks it, is that, I don't know, like if you were to give me a choices of things that I would want to know, you know, let's say choose, you could either know, I don't know, all of science or all of history. You can know all of the statistics of every sports athlete that has ever played, or you can know the difference between good and evil. I think I would choose the latter. I think I would choose knowledge of good and evil. I think it's very important to know the difference between good and evil, isn't it? It seems like it's really a great thing to know. Now, if that's so, and I told you there is a tree. One second, Andrew. I'm just reviewing, but I'm going to get to you in a minute, I promise. If that's so, and eating from this tree gives you knowledge of good and evil, well, wouldn't it be and you told me that, I would eat from it, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you want the knowledge to discern between good and evil? And if so, then why does God tell Adam not to eat from it? Right?
Why did he say you will die if you eat from it?
All right. And you die if you eat from it. Seems pretty harsh. And I would have told you Adam was right to eat from it. And he got knowledge of good and evil afterward. That seems like a good thing to get. So the whole thing's backwards, right? That was our question. Andrew, what did you want to add?
I'm wondering whether there's a further distinction between knowledge and free choice. Maybe they had knowledge, but they didn't have choice.
They only had instinctive knowledge. They didn't have determined knowledge.
You're like stealing my whole lecture over here. You got to do this.
Rolf, we weren't there.
No, but all these are great points. But it brings me to another point. Let me ask you the following question, okay? How would you define free choice? Let me give you an example, okay? let's start from something very basic, a baby. Alan mentioned before that I have a baby. Now, when a baby is hungry, they often cry. It's annoying. I wish they would learn how to communicate more effectively. You know, I tell my daughter all the time, maybe instead of crying, you should just say please and we're happy to help you. But it doesn't get through to her. She just continues to cry when she wants something. Does she have free will to decide whether or not to cry?
She's born
with
capacity for it, but she hasn't developed the skill.
Ralph distinguishes between capacity and skill. Meaning that she could physically, it is possible, I would think. Although I don't know that this is true. I would think it is possible. I'm just going to mute everyone if you have something to say. Always, everyone's welcome to unmute yourselves and participate. I would say, so Ralph is saying that she might physically be capable of not crying, but she doesn't have the capacity to make that choice. Yes, Paul, what do you think?
That's determinism. It's predetermined that when she has this feeling of hunger or this pain or this need to have her stomach filled, she reacts in a way by crying. That's all. That's the tools that she has. That's determinism. She doesn't choose to do that because every kid does that. That's predetermined how a baby grows.
So Paul says that she doesn't have free will. I mean, I think
not for that.
Meaning your argument is that she may have the physical capacity between, say, choice A is to not cry. Choice B is to cry. Right? Now, she might physically be capable of going with choice A, but her natural tendency is to cry. That's a natural reaction. And there is nothing driving her to not follow that natural reaction. It's almost as if it's not at her disposal, meaning without that skill, does she really have the capacity to do it? Right? So let's bring it a little bit further, right? So what if I said that, I'll give you two more examples, then we'll get into the crux of our discussion. Let's say you're talking about a high school student, okay? A high school student that likes their phone. She really likes her phone. And you go up to her and you say, give me your phone. As a teacher, give me the phone. What do you think will happen 99% of the time? When you tell a high school student without any explanation or justification or reason for doing so, hey, let's call her Aliza. Hey, Aliza, give me your phone. What do you think is going to happen? It's not going to be, sure, Rabbi Bergman, I would love to voluntarily give you my phone without any explanation as to why. Why not? Here it is. That's probably not going to happen. What's probably going to happen is, at best, why? What'd I do? That's usually the response. And so let's say you have that this teenager who is not like any goody two shoes. She's a normal teenager, but she has her own, attitude, whatever it is. And she's presented with the two choices. Choice one is to obediently and willingly give the phone up to the teacher without any explanation as to why. And choice two is to react in some way and refuse to give up that phone. Does she have the free will to choose between the two choices?
Rabbi, she's going to react anyways, because isn't most schools, I remember seeing this on the news, they put the phones, like when you walk into the thing, you have to put it on a table or something before you enter a classroom.
That's true, but that's not the case.
And then that means if she has it talking on the phone or something, that means she wants to have a reaction.
She wants her phone, right? That's justified. So I would say, now maybe it's a little different now. Maybe you'll say, she could, but it's very unlikely that she, like, that choice is almost not at her disposal. And if I give you another case where, let's say you walk into your living room, and in the living room there is a fireplace. that is burning a very hot fire. Now, you look at that fire and you have two choices. You could either put your finger inside the fire or you could not do that. Now, do you have the free will to choose choice A?
Yes.
So Paul says yes, and theoretically you do. It would take a lot, wouldn't it?
I didn't say you would do it. I just said you had the choice to do it.
Right. No, but what I'm saying is that you see there's gradations, I would say, of that opposition, right? Like you start with the baby who like almost has no choice but to cry. Theoretically, it's all the same physical capacity. But the question is, how strong is the, I guess, intellectual knowledge that there are two choices, and how strong is the will heavily weighing down on one of the choices? And there's always a balance between those two things, knowledge and will. So this is to your point, Andrew. I don't think knowledge and will are a bit different. And I think we can even distinguish between free choice and free will. Free will would, you could argue, should mean that you have both alternatives equally at your disposal. Now, I don't know if we believe that in Judaism. Maybe we don't have that. Maybe there is going to be one choice, which seems like it is weighing way more heavily. So free will and free choice are complicated topics. And there's always going to be a scale based on how much you want the other thing and how aware you are that you have a different choice. Alan, what do you want to say?
Sometimes you really don't have a choice. Sometimes it's your makeup. We say it was Avraham and his brother that were both put in the furnace, burning furnace, and Avraham managed to get out, and his brother couldn't get out. And it talks of why he couldn't get out, and it's like they're brothers, and you would say it's an equal chance to get out the furnace. But Avraham got out and his brother didn't.
Well, there's a story about the furnace. I think Alan points out that when we say free will, there's a lot of different parts to that. You know, one is to know. You have to know before you make a choice. So part of free will will be knowing the two alternatives. It's hard to say that you would have the will to choose either one of them if you didn't know that there was an alternative there, right? Then there's the freedom to choose one of those alternatives. But even when you make the choice, you have to actually go through with it. Like you might decide in your mind, I'm going to go with A. But then you have to have the ability to perform whatever action is necessary to choose A. And then even if you choose, it might not result in what you wanted. There's a lot of aspects of free will. It's not so simple. So in that, let's discuss this. I want to get to the end of the Rambam today. I want to sort of circle back to that, his whole stance on this.
Rabbi.
And then I want to get to the Rambam. We'll take one more comment before we get into it. Yeah.
I'll just bring this example up, but in terms of free choice. If we even look at the 10 tests that Avraham had.
Yes.
He couldn't choose the tests. But he did choose how he was going to respond to it.
Right. 100%.
And there are subcategories in many situations, even in the example that Alan gave with regards to the furnace. How he chose, he didn't have a choice with regards to the furnace, but he had a choice of how he was going to respond to it.
Right. That's true. So we don't have total freedom to choose the situations that we're in. Right. And you could argue that is sort of a lack in a certain sense of freedom of will, meaning I didn't want to be in the situation, and being in the situation just by definition predisposes me to certain, you know, emotions or fears, and it's upon me to sort of react to those. So now let's take a look at once again at what the Rambam said. It's a very difficult Rambam. So let me share my screen. I hope you'll be able to see it. And I want to go through the Rambam, and then I want to look at the Ramban's approach here, okay? So basically, what the Rambam says, again, our question was, it seems difficult to suggest that before eating from the tree of knowledge, Adam and Eve could not discern between good and evil. And if that was what gave them the ability to discern between good and evil, why did God punish them? It seems like that's a great thing to do. Wouldn't you want to discern between good and evil? Well, the Rambam says you're getting it all wrong. And he totally redefines the terms good and evil here. And there's a bit of ambiguity about what he means, but I want to make this as clear as possible. The Rambam says is, no, Adam and Eve had total and complete knowledge before they ate from the tree. But they had knowledge of Emet and Sheker. Emet meaning truth, Sheker meaning falsehood. And they had complete knowledge of what was true and what was false. What is an example of truth and false? The Rambam's example is the fact that the world revolves around the sun. That is true. You would not say it is good. It is true. But what they gained after eating from the tree of knowledge, what did they learn? They learned they were naked. They learned that we're naked. Now, being naked is, in this sense, evil. Now, if being naked is evil, evil doesn't mean immoral. Evil doesn't mean the sense of doing something that with moral virtue one shouldn't do. Evil, the way we're interpreting it, and it's a bit unclear. Evil might mean ugly. And again, you could argue maybe in certain societies it's not ugly to walk around naked. That's fair. But I think the way the Rambam sees it and the way the way he sees the Torah presenting it, that there's a certain perspective that you could use to view the world where we focus less on what is objectively true and more on what is subjectively pleasant or unpleasant. So if you were to see a beautiful sunset, then that's the good that they derived from eating from the tree of knowledge. Now they can get pleasure. Now they can appreciate, wow, that is beautiful. And if you were to hear a cacophonous array of sounds, now that is the evil that is being described in eating from this tree of knowledge. So the Rambam rejects the proposition. No, they totally knew the difference between truth and sheker, right? Truth and falsehood. And let's look at the end here, and then we'll discuss more, okay? So here's what the Rambam continues to say. When Adam was in a state of innocence, note that the Rambam is saying before eating from the tree of knowledge, he was in a state of innocence. Innocence. And was guided solely by reflection and reason. That there was no alternative. All his decisions were based on reflection and reason, the intellect. On account of which it is said, you had made him, man, a little lower than the angels, right? God made humans with the capability to know. He was not at all able to follow or to understand the principles of quote-unquote apparent truth. The most manifest impropriety, meaning to appear in a state of nudity, was nothing unbecoming according to his idea. He cannot comprehend why it should be so. What's wrong with walking around nude? Adam and Eve didn't know. They didn't know because walking around nude, according to the Rambam, the way he's presenting it, isn't evil in the sense that we mean it. It is grotesque. It is inappropriate. It is ugly. You look at that, you look at someone that walks around naked, and what's your reaction? Yuck. That's out of place. That doesn't fit. That's not supposed to be what you do. You're supposed to wear clothes. But it's not evil. It's not evil in the sense of murder. That's not an evil thing to do. It's just out of place. After man's disobedience, how everyone began to give way to his desires, which had their source in his imagination, and to the gratification of his bodily appetites, as it is said, and the wife saw the tree was good for food and delightful to the eyes, he was punished by the loss of part of that intellectual faculty which he had previously possessed. Meaning, basically, the decision, and here's the beauty of it, the decision to look at the tree of knowledge, according to the Rambam, is the beginning of the sin. It's not just the eating, right? Because when you go back to the story, what happens after Eve talks to the snake? She looks at the tree. She looks at it. Ooh, that's a good tree. It's good to eat. It's good to look at. That, for the Rambam, is the point at which Eve decides to not focus on what is true and what is false, but rather what is pleasant and what is unpleasant, what is desirable and what is undesirable. Apparently, right, so they didn't have that. They didn't have this appetite beforehand. They didn't have that strong drive to the aesthetic, to that which is pleasing. And that's what they got. And it says, he therefore transgressed. And it's once Adam and Eve look at that tree, and therefore focus on that which is beautiful, then they gain this desire. He therefore transgressed the command with which he had been charged on the score of his reason. And having obtained the knowledge of the apparent truths, he was wholly absorbed in the study of, and this is, I don't think, a good or an interesting translation, what's proper and what improper. Then he fully understood the magnitude of the loss he had sustained, what he had forfeited, and in what situation he was thereby placed. Hence we read, and you shall be like Elohim, nobility, knowing good and evil, and not knowing or discerning the true and the false. Now you look at things and you look at whether or not it's proper. Is that pleasing? That's the new thing. In accordance to this interpretation, our text suggests that Adam, as he altered his intention and directed his thoughts to the acquisition of what was forbidden, he was banished from paradise. This was his punishment. It was measure for measure. At first, he had the privilege of tasting pleasure and happiness and of enjoying repose and security. But his appetites grew stronger and he followed his desires and impulses and partook of the food he was forbidden to taste. He was deprived of everything, was doomed to subsist on the meanest kind of food such as he has never tasted, and even only after exertion and labor.
But isn't that truth too? Isn't beauty truth?
So that's the question, okay? So let's just get the summary and then I want to discuss it, okay? So what the Rambam is basically saying is that what happened when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge is not that they gained knowledge. It's not knowledge in the sense of knowing what is good and what is evil. What they gained was an appreciation for the pleasant and unpleasant, the uncomfortable and the uncomfortable. What you are basically sensory pleasure. In essence, it's that when you see something, when you taste something good, to use that word, and you like it, it's not that it's good in the sense of right and wrong. It's good in the sense of it fits, it works, you like it, it's appropriate. That's what they did. And what's actually ironic then is that for the Rambam, here's the irony of the whole saying. By focusing on the pleasant and unpleasant, their lives were made that much more unpleasant. Because they went after sensory desire, they were in paradise. So before they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Adam and Eve are in paradise and they have all the pleasures in the world, but they don't focus on it. Because they're after truth. They're after that which is true. They aren't really interested in the pleasant and unpleasant. But once they make that their focus, now God says, I can't just allow you to continue engaging in endless pleasantries. Now you have to leave. Now your life is not going to be so pleasant. And that's the way the Rambam views this story. Okay. Now let me just mention one problem with the Rambam, and then I want to move on to the Ramban, but I want to take questions, okay? Here's the problem with the Rambam. There's a few problems, okay? Let's mention a few, and I want to hear what you think also. Problem number one, Tov and Ra. Tov and Ra. What do Tov and Ra usually mean? When you say something, someone should be good in the Torah, doesn't it usually mean good in the sense of objectively so, that it's the good thing to do? The Torah tells us that Hashem saw what he created. What did he say? What does God say after he creates something? He saw that it was?
Tov. Good.
Tov. Good. Wait, Rambam. So did God see that it was pleasant? Did God see that it was aesthetically pleasing? So the Rambam is doing a whole trick here. He has to say that Tov means different things in different contexts. And I'll bring you one more thing. The Rambam in the Yad HaChazakah, if you look in the Rambam's work in his Laws of Tshuva, look at what he says here. Rishut, and this is Paul, this is the Rambam about free will. And I know it's, you know, there are issues with it, but let's see what he says. Reshut l'chol adam netuna. A person is giving authority. If a person wants to be righteous and veer toward the path of good, he can do so. And if a person wants to be wicked and evil, they can do that too. What's the proof? How do you know? How do you know that a person has free will? Check out the Rambam's proof. That is the meaning of what it writes in the Torah. The proof he brings is from the verse after Adam and Eve eat from the tree, where God says, now man has become like one of us, though that's not what it means according to the Rambam, knowing good and evil. Meaning, klomar, hein min ze shel Adam haya yachid ba'olam, that now man is unique. Man is unique. That's how the Rambam reads it. Man is unique. No one else is like humans in this way. That humans, by their knowledge from themselves with their thoughts, from him, to know good and evil. They can by themselves know, discern between good and evil. They can do whatever they want. No one withholds them from doing good and evil. Therefore, since they can choose to do what they want, to choose between good and evil, now that they know the difference between that which is good and evil, and they can choose either one, I'm afraid they're going to eat from the tree of knowledge. In this Rambam, how does the Rambam define good and evil? How does the Rambam define good in this Rambam?
Objective good and bad. Objective good.
It means good. It means that which is good. It means righteous. It means choosing to be a tzaddik. So the Rambam contradicts himself. It's a big problem. I don't know a solution to this problem. In the Mor Nevuchim, in the Guide for the Perplexed, the Rambam writes good in this sense doesn't mean good in the sense of moral. But in the Yad HaChazakah, that's exactly what he says. He says, this is the source of good, of free will. And so the Rambam, although very interesting, the Rambam, I think, raises very important questions as to the question of what is truly good and what is evil. Is being naked evil? And the Rambam sounds like he's saying, no, it is not. It is not evil. It is inappropriate. It doesn't fit. And we could sort of ask ourselves that there are all sorts of decisions we make in our lives, right? And on what basis do we make those decisions? Do we make them based on what is, quote unquote, emet v'sheker, true and false, truly what I'm supposed to be doing or not? And that's one way to make decisions. But there's another way. What is pleasant and what is unpleasant? Do we view things through that prism? What is going to be most enjoyable for me? And that is a totally new way of looking at the world. That's how Adam and Eve look at the world after eating from the tree of knowledge. That being said, it's a difficult read. It's a very difficult read for the Rambam. He has to be very flexible with defining Tov and Ra, which is difficult. There are a few psukim he has to sort of take out of their context. He has to reread them. But that is the approach of the Rambam to this issue. Any thoughts or observations before I move to the Rambam? Yes, Paul.
Why didn't God give us all these things right at the beginning when he created man? What was the lesson that he wanted to teach us? I mean, why didn't we get all these abilities when we were created?
That's a great question. So let me to answer.
And the second question.
It could be.
And the second.
It could be. Oh, sorry. What's your second question?
Well, yeah. The second question is, comes Yom Kippur when the book is open and the names of those who are going to live and the names of those who are going to die. How does that jive with free will?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. But that, I think, relates to what Andrew said, which is that free will does not mean that you control what happens to you. That's not what free will means. It's not what it means. You do not control what happens to you.
You control a lot what happens to you. You control a lot what happens to you. I can walk down the street and walk in the middle of the street and get hit by a car. I can control that.
Not really.
I can't control the car.
You cannot control whether or not you get hit by a car because it's the car that hits you.
No, but I can, if the car slips on ice and then mounts the sidewalk and kills me, I have no control, but I can control not walking down the middle of Bathurst Street.
Well, you sort of can. You can make a decision that you're going to walk, but your body has to process that decision. And in before you start walking, somebody, you know, I don't want to say you because this is just too intense. But if Sally wants to walk down the street, she might decide to make that decision. But then a bulldozer might come and smash the street. And then she cannot walk down the street. So you never control. You do not control what happens to you. That is not what free will means. As Andrew said before, you can control how you decide in your mind to react. And you may not be able to carry out that decision. Free will does not mean you control what happens to you.
You can influence what happens to you.
Yeah, you can influence. And maybe you can...
You can choose to smoke or not to smoke.
Or death. You can influence it. It's possible that...
You can choose not to... You can choose to smoke or not to smoke.
That's true. But even when you say that, you can choose not to smoke. Well, I guess theoretically, let's say you're saying you can choose to smoke. But what if you make the choice to pick up a cigarette... And then lo and behold, you go to your room and there are no cigarettes left because someone stole them.
No, but what I'm saying is you can.
I understand what you're saying. I don't want to go back and forth. I totally understand what you're saying, but I'm saying everyone would agree that it's limited. You don't really get to choose whether or not your decisions come to fruition. You can make a decision and you don't get to do it. Anyways, but I think your question about why does God not give us stuff? So I want to throw one thought out there. And I think some of us have suggested before, and that is maybe this is all supposed to happen. Maybe we're supposed to eat from the tree of good knowledge. Maybe it's all sort of a story about the nature of man, humans, men and women, and how these factors and then this knowledge plays into our lives. I want to get to that maybe in another week. I'll just put that in your minds for now. But in terms of your other question, I think it's a really interesting question, meaning you're sort of saying, why didn't God give us a knowledge of what's pleasant and unpleasant beforehand? Well, how good is it to focus on that knowledge? What if we didn't know what was pleasant and unpleasant? It's worth thinking about. How would that change our lives? What if I made all my decisions not based on what's pleasant and unpleasant, but just based on what's true and not true, or what's right and wrong? And I didn't care about pleasant and not pleasant. It would be an interesting life, wouldn't it? But I don't think it's so simple. On the one hand, you could say that, you know, not appreciating beauty is a sort of lack of a human experience. There's something wonderful about subjective experience, wonderful about subjectivity, isn't there? There's something wonderful about the fact that I sometimes go through things that I really like and some things that I don't like. It makes us human. Back to the robot question, right? You know, I don't know. Robots know the difference between truth and not truth, but do they know the difference between necessarily pleasant and unpleasant? Can they enjoy like the way humans can enjoy? So it really begs the question, would it be better if we lived some sort of objective experience and everything was just true or not or untrue? And I think this leads us to the Ramban very nicely. So let's get to the Ramban. The Ramban is going to say something, and I think it's very problematic at first glance. Let's take a look at what he says, and I'm going to go back to my PowerPoint. And I hope that you can at least cover some of this today. So let us go to the Ramban. The Ramban says as follows. The Ramban is defining what the tree of knowledge was. Here's what he says. This is what I think. The Ramban first presents another approach, which I hope to get to next week. But he says, I don't like that approach. And here's my approach. That humans originally did whatever what was proper for them to do naturally. They followed their natural tendencies. Like the sky and all their hosts do. This is a line from, anybody know? This is a line prayer we say when we sanctify the new moon, which should happen soon. Good Chodesh, by the way. Chodesh Tov, everyone. I really do hope it is a wonderful Shvat. So on that vein, when we see the new moon, we say Kiddush Levana in a few, maybe next Motzei Shabbat. Let's all live and be well. We say this line. humans were like the moon. The moon does what it's supposed to do. It does not veer from its path. Ein lahem b'maasem avasana. There is no love or hate in their actions. Upri ha'ilan hazeh haya molid haratzon v'hachifetz. The fruit of this tree bore, gave birth to will and desire. It gave birth to will. So yitcheru ochlav bedavar obehevcho latov olara. That they should, those who eat it would choose something or its opposite for good or for evil. Lachein nikra eitz hadat dovara. That's why it's called the tree of quote unquote da'at of good and evil. Hiadat yomar belishonenu al halashon. In our language in Hebrew, da'at doesn't always mean intellectual perception. Da'at can mean will, to want something, to desire something. And he gives a few examples. Close to Shonam, he gives you an example from the Talmud. I don't think I had this in the translation. I apologize. Lo shelo shanu el shadaito daito lachazor. This is referring to a law that if you forgot on before Passover, not to get anybody to perturbed about Passover. It's a few months away, but in a few months it will be Passover. And before Passover, you are supposed to check your house for chametz. That's called bedikat chametz. But if you're going on vacation, then you have a question. Should you check your house before you leave or not? And the Gemara says here that if you intend on returning, if daito lachazor, if you intend on returning to your house, then even if you go away before Pesach, since you intend on returning before the holiday begins, you don't have to check. The point being, though, daito lachazor does not mean you're aware of the fact that you can return. It means that you want to return. You have a desire to return.
It could be enough to say just that he has knowledge that he will return. Could be enough to say that too, right?
Right. Martin says maybe it could be knowledge. But how do you, when you say you have knowledge that you will return, but how do you know you will return? It's only if you want to. That's the way he's saying it.
Yeah.
Olaf Anoto.
Well, the trouble I have with this is because I wonder why they're taking, changing basic words like will is really ratzon. So this say ratzon. Okay.
You make a good
don't
point.
Say something point. Else. Don't say something else. Don't change the meanings.
Well, so the Ramban says that there are a lot of times, let's read some more of examples. And you don't have to be convinced. The part of the Ramban is responding to the knowledge issue. He doesn't think it's knowledge. He doesn't think it's knowledge. He thinks because he doesn't think that's the way the story works. Like, look, Lashon HaKatu, Ma Adam v'tei da'ehu. God says about humans, or the angels tell God about the human race, men and women, what are humans that you should da'ehu? Tachpots v'tirtzebo, right? The angels are saying not what is man that you should know him, but rather what is man that you should desire him. Why do you want humans? God, why do you have a will for there to be humans? We're good enough. That's the point. Yidaticha b'shem, right? God says to Moses, I have known you by name, b'charticha mikol adam. And he gives another proof here, an interesting story. So there's a story here about Barzillai HaGiladi. Barzillai helped out David HaMelech when he was running from Absalom, but he got a little bit old. And he says, Ha'eda ben tov lara. Do I know between good and evil? What does that mean, Eda ben tov lara? Not that I know, I do know. She'ava mimenu koach harayon. In his old age, he lost the ability to want. Lo yabocha b'dav v'lo katzpo. He wouldn't choose one thing or the other. Ve'ochel mebli shi'etam b'shomem mebli shi'etan eg b'shir. He would eat without taste and listen to music without enjoying it. Point being, da'at means ratzon. Here's the kicker. That at this time, men and women had no desire for intercourse, for sexual intercourse. When it was time for them to have children, which hadn't happened yet, presumably, but if it would happen, then they would be together and give birth. But there was no desire to do it. It was just, okay, it's something that you do.
But the Gemara says that... without that kind of will, without that kind of desire, nothing would grow. I mean,
that's a good question. That's the Gemara, right? This is a good question. If the Ramban is right, well, the Ramban is saying, well, I guess the Ramban is saying that there is a need, a physiological need, that's there, that sort of drives the reproductive cycle. And they had knowledge, maybe, that it is worthwhile to have children, but they didn't have a desire for the pleasure of it. Now, you could argue, but the desire for the pleasure of it, I think that's what you're arguing, Martin. No, it's good to have that desire. It's important. People wouldn't do anything otherwise. And I'm not disagreeing. My response would be that that's because we live in the world after sin, and we are motivated to do things based on our enjoyment of them. It's very hard for us to act without the motivation of pleasure. But before the sin, Adam and Eve did not need the motivation of pleasure to act. They didn't need that. They were able to do things without that motivation. It's not what drove them, right? It wasn't that money runs the world. Money did not make the world go around before Adam and Eve. It was the right thing that made the world. It was morality that made the world go around.
And did they, in fact, do everything for God consciousness? In other words, was that will that was the truth, or the truth or the falseness that they saw the world through, was that based on God consciousness?
God consciousness. I would think so. I would think so. But there is a huge problem with this, which I hope that many of you are probably thinking about. But let's just finish. He says, therefore, it says that when they were together, why were they not embarrassed about being nude? It's because what makes it embarrassing is a certain feeling of guilt associated with the desire and temptation for sexual pleasure. That's what makes us uncomfortable with those organs. And Adam and Eve had no such desire or temptation, and therefore they had no problem being naked because those organs were the same as every other organ. And here's the kicker. The way the Rambam says it, the Ramban, Nachman, he says this, is after they ate from the tree, Adam and Eve had bechira. What does bechira mean? Choice. Uvritzona is really fascinating. It was within their ratzon, their will, lehara o lehitiv, to do evil or good, bein lo, bein la'achirim, whether to themselves or to others. Vizu mida elokit nitzad achad. Here's the kicker. This is a godly attribute on the one hand, v'ra'al adam biot lo ba yetzer v'taiva, but it is bad. It is evil for humans because by having this, they have temptation. So that is what the Ramban says. The Ramban says, let's take a thought for a second. The Ramban says, what does da'at mean? It means will, ratzon, desire. By eating from the tree, they attained desire. And it is by attaining desire that the pleasure within certain activities. And that's what made them embarrassed to be nude. That's what made them embarrassed to be naked. But before eating from the tree, they may have known good and evil, but they had no desire to do one or the other. There was no desire there. They didn't look at an evil act and say, I want that. They naturally did good. They naturally did what God wanted them to do. That is what the Ramban says. Just as the moon and the stars do what God wants them to do, that is what Adam and Eve would do naturally.
It doesn't sound as exciting as the latter.
What'd you say?
It doesn't sound as exciting a lifestyle as the latter.
So this is a good point, right? So was that really the good thing to do? Is that really the way God wanted it? I think it's a really interesting question to think about. Did God want us to go through life without desire? What would life be? But there's also the same, so that's a really interesting question. And you know what? The Ramban agrees to you. You know why? Because if you look back, and let me show you again. If you look back at what the Ramban says, he says something really interesting about what happened. Now they ate from it, bertsono lahara o lehitiv bein lo bein la'acherim. Now they could have a will to do that which is right and that which is wrong to others. The Ramban's saying they couldn't do kindness before. Before they ate from the tree of knowledge, they couldn't perform acts of kindness. They couldn't do evil or good to others.
They didn't really know what an act of kindness was.
Yes, that's exactly it. I want to get
back. It wasn't part of their nature.
Yeah, sorry. Should I say again?
Kindness wasn't part of their nature. Unkindness wasn't part of their nature.
Right. Why?
They just did what comes naturally.
Well, I think they might have known intellectually that it's good to do an act of kindness. But here's what I think it means. This is where Weiderblank suggests, Natano Weiderblank, and I think it's right. How do you know what is kind to someone else? How do you make that evaluation? How do you know what they want if you don't want anything? Kindness, by definition, means that you can perceive that somebody wants something, that they're lacking something, and they want it, right? So, basic kindness, you're walking down the street and you see someone is in need of money. Then the kind thing to do is to give them the money if you have the money to give them. But you have to perceive that they want money. And if you can perceive that they're missing anything, it's just there's no will, there's no desire for anything, so then you can't really be kind to them. And you wouldn't want to do that either. You wouldn't have. So you make a great point. It's really interesting to think about. And again, maybe God wanted us to have these desires. Maybe that's part of the story. But there is a big problem here. There is a big problem, and I think this sort of will help us understand this deeper. What's the big problem with saying that Adam and Eve had no will? The Ramban is saying that Adam and Eve had knowledge. They knew. They understood intellectually. You could probably have a good philosophical discussion with them about evil and good based on their God consciousness, as Martin discussed before. But they had no will to do anything else but what they naturally would do, which is they would naturally do what God wants them to do, because that makes sense.
Nope.
But what's the problem with saying that?
Robert, didn't they also learn things from the animals? Like a dog
maybe
is
they
a,
did. Maybe they did. That's,
a dog is like a gentle thing, or a lion. Like a lion could be very nice and caregiving, right. And it could be very vicious. Like,
yeah, animals can be nice, right? But I think that they, like, I think what would happen
only to their own kind.
Pleasure.
Well, I think what would happen is that, you know, if you would go to Adam and Eve and you would say, like, you know, wow, I have this amazing sandwich, like, you want some, they'd be like, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. Like, oh, what do you mean amazing? What's amazing about it? They wouldn't understand what that means. So they might have seen lions being, you know, ferocious, but they wouldn't understand, well, why are they doing that? Unless that's what they think they should do. They wouldn't desire.
But they talked to a snake.
Desire.
But they weren't afraid of a snake.
So that's the problem.
Oh, it isn't a snake like we know it.
So the snake.
Oh,
the
come snake, on, Ralph.
The big
problem. It had rattles at the end of it.
The big problem with the Ramban is the same question, isn't it? Well, if they naturally did what God wanted them to do, and they had no will to do otherwise, well, I'll ask you two questions. Number one, did they have free will? Is it free will if you have no will? They might have had the power to do certain things, but if they had no desire to do them, is that really free will? And I'll ask you, and I'll add another thing. How could they have sinned? If they naturally did what Hashem wanted them to do, and Hashem told them, do not eat from the tree of knowledge, and they had no desire to transgress the will of God, then what made them do so?
They had no desire, but it was the snake that convinced them that they should exercise desire.
100% beautiful. And that, I think, is the point here. It was the snake. And what the snake is telling them basically is, you're missing out on desire. And let's think about the argument here for a second, right? Let's think about this argument, and then we'll read some of this inside. Maybe we'll get to it now. The snake's argument isn't just in this read, wow, look at the yummy fruit. Don't you want some? Because they wouldn't have understood that. What the snake is saying is you are missing out on a fundamental part of what it means to have free will. Because although you know what is good and what is evil, but you don't have any desire to do evil. And without the desire to live life in a certain way, can you really say that you're making free decisions? Says the snake to Adam and Eve, don't you want to be like God? God has ratzon. God has will. God willed the world into existence. God willed that the Jews should leave Egypt. God has will. You don't have will. You're missing out on what it means to make a decision, says the snake to Adam and Eve. You're missing out. You're not really the owner of your decisions.
Rabbi?
Don't you want to have free will? That's what the snake says to Adam and Eve.
Where did the snake get this knowledge?
Rabbi?
Okay, well, yeah. So, yes, Andrew. And I'll get to...
Is there anything written about the decision to eat from the tree is when they got the free will, as opposed to after having eaten from it?
Right. That's a great point. I would say, so the Ramban says that it's when they eat, but you're making a good point. Andrew makes the point that at what point
that consciousness may have happened by that interaction with whatever this reptile is.
Yes, it sounds like
the apple is the confirmation of that.
Meaning, I think what I would say is that they didn't have will. So here's what I would say. They probably comprehended the fact that they didn't have will. They probably comprehended the fact they didn't care about pleasantness. They probably comprehended that. They sensed certain things. They probably comprehended that they were missing something.
And what they were missing was what the snake had that they didn't have.
Right. That's what the snake had. The snake
so
said,
that's, desire
you...
its, he that's had, a desire in itself.
He
own
has
life.
A knowledge. He already right. had the knowledge of good and evil.
Right, in a certain sense. The snake has will. The snake has things that it wants, and it tells Adam and Eve, and again, whether it's a real, again, this is all, you know, just a story to teach us lessons. The snake says to Adam and Eve, you're missing out on will. I'm telling you, you want it. It's good. And it's not just that will is yummy, right? It's not just that the tree tastes good. It's that you're not really making decisions until you have will. You're not really fully in control of yourself because you're just like the baby who starts crying when they're hungry. You're just like, you know, the person who won't put their fingers in the fire. Yes, you're deciding not to put it in the fire, but you have absolutely no desire to put it in the fire. So it's not really at your disposal. And that was how Adam and Eve experienced everything. And the snake says, you're missing subjective experience. You're missing out on what it means to really live in this world.
So Rabbi, just wanted to ask you, in Shachrit in the morning, we say a prayer regarding Da'at. What is the Atachonen le'adam Da'at?
Yes.
What exactly are we at?
You're asking a good question. So I think the Ramban would admit that that's a certain type of knowledge. But I think you're right, and it's not will. But in Jewish thought, I would just say that there is a difference between types of knowledge, and that Da'at is a certain. And let me. This will be the next source. There's a certain type of knowledge that you connect to. That's not objective. It just becomes part of who you are. It's not just that you happen to know it, but it becomes part and parcel of your experience. I think that's what Da'at really is. Da'at also means connection. It says, Adam yada et chava isho. Adam knew Eve, but that means he knew her intimately. So I would say Daat is more than just intellectual comprehension. It is something that integrates that intellectual comprehension into who you are. But let me at least end with this next source. And this is what Nefesh HaChaim says. Nefesh HaChaim says, now bring this all back together. So what we're saying is that before Adam and Eve eat from the tree of knowledge, they didn't have will, but they had a snake who was telling them, you're making a big mistake. Don't you want to be like God? If you eat from the tree, you're going to want things. You're going to have a willpower, and that will make you more godlike. And then what happens afterward is the snake isn't no longer a snake. It becomes part of who we are. Take a look at what he says here. What is the Eitz HaDaat Tov HaRa? Says Chaim Volozhiner. Chaim Volozhiner, prominent Rosh Yeshiva in the early 1800s of Volozhin, says as follows. Yes, Adam and Eve had full choice. They could do what they wanted. Maybe not
terrible,
but let's focus on what he said. He said, "Tachli kavanat kol briya." That's the purpose of creation, that we should choose good. How could they have sinned if they didn't have this choice? Of course they could choose, or else they wouldn't have sinned.
But it was just theoretical choice.
Yeah. But hold, yes, exactly. But that choice wasn't on account of the fact that the evil force was inside of them. Speaking in spiritual terms here, but he was a completely straight and upright person, composed of only the forces of holiness. All of his matters were totally pure and purified. There was no tendency toward evil at all. The evil forces were external. The nachash, the snake, is external. It's outside our persona. We may know about evil. Evil may entice it, but it wasn't part of who we were. Just like you could choose to jump into the furnace. You could choose to do that, but it's not. There's no internal drive to do so. It's not part of you. Like a person can choose to go into the fire. And look what happens. When the Sitra Achra, the other side, meaning the forces of evil, wanted to get Adam to sin, they had to go from outside. Lo kemoshu atasha yeter mefata adam hu betoch adam atzma. Not like now that the evil, the temptation which causes us to sin, is inside, it's part of who we are. Umitamel adam shu atzmo, and a person thinks that they are their desire. Who I wrote that? I'm the one that wants it. B'nimshach la'asot avon. V'lo sh'acher chutzmeni. When we want something, it's us who wants it. When we want that fruit from the tree, we feel like it's we who want it. B'chato sh'nimshach acher pito yisit sh'acher. Az nit arvu ha'kochot ha'rabba tocho mamash. But when he sinned and ate and followed the snake, then the forces of evil became part of him, part of the human experience.
Dominate.
Yes. V'zeu eitz HaDaat Tov HaRa, shenitchamru v'nitarvu b'tocho. Da'at Tov HaRa means that they became connected and part of who Adam and Eve were. Uva'alomot Tov HaRa, and in the world as well. The world became now a place of mixture of evil and good. Ki da'at perosh chabrut kayadua. Right? So what happened was the world was originally a very clear place. It was clear what was good and what was evil. Evil was external. You knew what was good. There was no internal struggle there. It was 100% clear. But after listening to the snake, what happens is everything is unclear. Everything is clouded. We don't know what's good and evil. Look what's happening nowadays. Look at all the confusion in the world. What are we supposed to think? You know, throwing some politics in here. I'm not going to do that, actually. I'm going to stay away from that. The point is, there's so many times in our lives where we don't know what's good and what's evil, where it's all a mixture, where it's all concealed, where it's confusing. And that is now the plight of humanity. Now, I guess I'll leave you with the question. Do you think we're better off than we were beforehand? God wants us to live with no subjective desire for anything, with no internal drive at all?
But
or is it better now that we have those drives, we have to overcome them?
This is what God wanted us to be.
I think there are arguments either way, but I hear you.
And I Rabbi, excuse me, Rabbi.
That's a good
question. I want to take the question. I wanted to say, it's 8:31, so thank you all.
For Rabbi, me. Very quickly.
Yeah.
Very quickly. The snake has now retained counsel. Please do not make any statements concerning the snake's activities. Direct all questions about the snake's activities through appropriate counsel, please.
Okay, yeah. He got a bum rap.
I hear you, Ruff. You're blaming the snake too hard here. I hear that. So I think we discussed today two different perspectives on what evil and good are. And I think those really do inform every decision that we make. What is good and what is evil? You know, and are we being driven by pleasantness or truth? And who are we actually? And what does it mean to make a choice? And what does it mean to have will and to overcome our will?
And where does
Rabbi, you're
part of the lesson of the story of paradise. So thank you very much for listening. We'll pick it up next week. The help of God.
Make sure you've got a good retainer if you've got a snake as a client.